Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I should be in Georgia now. I should be in Florida now. I should be in a lot of different places right now campaigning, and I'm sitting here.
It's not where he wants to be, but Donald Trump has a front row seat to an unprecedented piece of American history. For the first time, a former president is on trial. There's paperwork at the heart of the case and no cameras on the courtroom, but the elements of blockbuster legal drama are there. Hush money, hotel rooms, and a defendant who could be going to jail or back to the White House. Welcome to Your World Tonight. I'm Stephanie Skenderis. It's Monday, April 22nd, coming up on 6 p.m. Eastern Time, also on the podcast.
It'll be the largest deal in Canadian history. And sorry to tease the crowd, well, they'd shoot me if I told them who it's for.
Doug Ford may not be authorized to share details, but we can tell you the big deal is with Honda. As governments try to lure the booming electric vehicle industry to Canada, the automaker is expected to announce a multi-billion dollar plan for new EV plants in Ontario. Cars may be getting greener, but Canada has a plastic problem. A new registry is aimed at tracking plastic waste and making producers more responsible for it. The first ever criminal trial involving a former U.S. president began hearing legal arguments today. Opening statements were made in the case against Donald Trump. He's facing 34 counts of falsifying business records and is accused of making hush money payments to a former adult entertainment star in a case that has gripped headlines. The first witness called was the former publisher of a tabloid newspaper. Katie Simpson has the details.
I just want to say before we begin, these are all Biden trials.
Donald Trump seemed frustrated and animated as he walked into court yet again making history as the first former U.S. president to face criminal prosecution.
This is a witch hunt and it's a shame.
He sat at a table alongside his legal team as jurors were let into the room for brief instructions from the judge before opening statements began. Matthew Colangelo outlined the case for the prosecution, arguing that Trump engaged in a criminal conspiracy and cover-up in a bid to stop negative stories about him from being made public. The case centers around the documentation of payments to porn star Stormy Daniels to keep their alleged affair secret in the final days of the 2016 election campaign. Prosecutors argue the payments made by Trump's then lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen were recorded as legal fees when Cohen was reimbursed. Colangelo called it election fraud, pure and simple, arguing that Trump and his team wanted to hide the true nature of the payments.
They're going to try to emphasize that this is a business fraud case. This is not private dealings between two individuals, former President Trump and Stormy Daniels.
Michael Zeldin is a former U.S. federal prosecutor.
But rather, this is an effort by the campaign of Donald Trump to suppress negative information, to influence the outcome of that election, and then, after the fact, hide that fraud on their books.
Trump's defense team, led by Todd Blanche, countered by arguing that President Trump is innocent and that he did not commit any crimes, and tried to make Trump more relatable to the jury, saying he's a man, he's a husband, he's a father, he's a person just like you and just like me. Blanche argued that there's nothing wrong with trying to influence an election, a point he hit by saying, spoiler alert, and that it's called democracy. He also went on the offensive, attacking Michael Cohen's credibility. He is expected to be the star witness for the prosecution, arguing that Cohen was not given any sort of payback related to Daniels.
This is a case where you pay a lawyer and they call it a legal expense. And another thing that wasn't even said was we never even deducted it as a tax deduction.
The first witness, David Pecker, a longtime friend of Trump's, who was also the publisher of the tabloid The National Enquirer, briefly took the stand before court broke for the day. When the trial resumes Tuesday, he's expected to be pressed on working with Trump in the past to suppress embarrassing stories. Katie Simpson, CBC News, Washington.
Canada's auto sector is expected to get a big boost. Honda has reportedly agreed to build electric vehicles in Canada. Details of the multi-billion dollar agreement are expected on Thursday, but already Ontario's premier is teasing it as the largest deal in Canadian history. Tom Perry breaks down everything we know so far.
This week, we've landed a new deal. It'll be the largest deal in Canadian history.
Like the town gossip who can't keep a secret, Ontario Premier Doug Ford was practically bursting today, dropping hints in front of a business audience in Toronto that an announcement was coming on electric vehicles, a big one.
So stay tuned. We'll be announcing it this week. And sorry to tease the crowd, but they'd shoot me if I told them who it's for.
The premier wasn't naming names, but government sources have told CBC News the Japanese automaker Honda will announce a multi-billion dollar plan to build new facilities in Ontario to produce batteries, battery components, and battery-powered vehicles. Federal Industry Minister François-Philippe Champagne would not confirm any of that today, but says it's not surprising global automakers would want to do more business in Canada.
You see all the manufacturers looking at Canada because we are attractive. We have the talent. We have the very strong ecosystem. We have the critical minerals, renewable energy, access to market.
Canada has also been willing to put up public money to support auto sector investment. The federal government, along with Ontario and Quebec, have offered billions of dollars in incentives to attract major projects by Volkswagen, Stellantis, and the Swedish battery maker Northvolt. Last week's federal budget offered a 10% tax credit to encourage firms to set up electric vehicle manufacturing plants like the one Honda is expected to announce. Joe McCabe is president and CEO of Auto Forecast Solutions, a firm that tracks trends in the auto sector. He says despite concerns, demand for electric vehicles may be softening, Honda's plan, at least what's known of it, looks solid. With a focus on building EVs more people can afford.
We think it's actually perfect timing that they sort of watch the market conditions. They weathered all the market conditions with their current balanced portfolio. And now they're going to say, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, we think it's going to have really a takeoff, where we're going to have more well-priced vehicles over the next 3 years of bringing that new mass market consumer, a more $45,000 product, not a $60,000, $70,000, and $90,000 product out there. And then they're going to hit the sweet spot of, okay, now we have a very solid product to come in right when that next inflection point of EV adoption should take off.
But right now, there are few details, as the Ontario Premier says, stay tuned. Tom Perry, CBC News, Ottawa.
Take a walk outside in just about any city, town, or community in this country, and you'll see the evidence of a growing global crisis. Plastic waste on streets, in parks, in waterways. Today, the federal government announced a new plan as it tries to tackle the problem. A new plastics registry to track all the plastic that's being produced here. Anand Ram has the details.
Protesters marched through Ottawa's downtown core yesterday, trying to catch the ears of global negotiators in town. Today, on the eve of those talks towards a binding global treaty to curb plastic pollution, Canada's Environment Minister Stephen Guilbeault announced how the government will start to measure the problem in this country.
The registry will require plastic producers to take more responsibility. They must declare the quantity and types of plastic they supply.
A registry to track plastic from the source, from manufacturing to final product. Krista Seaman is VP of Plastics at the Chemistry Industry Association of Canada. She says industry isn't opposed, but
we think that's a pretty big ask at the very beginning. So we'd really like to see the registry at least initially focus on those items that have the highest potential to become plastic pollution.
The government estimates more than 4 million tons of plastic waste ends up in Canadian landfills annually. But critics say the problem with plastic also involves how it's made.
There are 16,000 chemicals that are used in different types of plastic.
Saba Khan is with the David Suzuki Foundation. She says a quarter of those chemicals are known to be hazardous to human health and wants the government to do more to track them.
So it's not just by seeing where it goes. It's actually by restricting, banning the toxicity and going towards more chemical simplification.
But with microplastics being found in animals, humans, and in remote corners of the earth, researchers say cleanup has to be the second priority. Tony Walker studies microplastics at Dalhousie University.
You really have to stem this from the source. So, for example, if my bathtub was overflowing, I wouldn't get a mop out cleaning the floor. I'd turn the tap off first.
Virtually all plastic comes from carbon-emitting fossil fuels. Maya Hurd is with the School of Environmental Studies at Queen's University. She says the registry could remind people of that often forgotten fact.
I think we get a much truer sense of the reality, which is that most of the environmental impact happens before we even consume the product.
Today's measures are going to be phased in, with the first reports to the new plastic registry expected by September of 2025. Without more action, around the world, plastic waste is expected to almost triple by the year 2060. Anand Ram, CBC News, Toronto.
Still ahead on the podcast, a political showdown in the UK as voting begins on a bill to deport failed asylum seekers to Rwanda. And police and prosecutors in Toronto face more questions after the man accused of killing an officer is cleared. Plus, millions of people have been affected by Sudan's civil war. So why isn't it getting more attention from the rest of the world? We'll have those stories coming up on Your World Tonight. An independent report has found the UN agency aiding Palestinian refugees needs to strengthen its neutrality. Israel has claimed hundreds of UNRWA workers are also members of Hamas. The report says Israel did not provide proof of those claims. The panel did find UNRWA has neutrality procedures in place, but they aren't always enforced. Former French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna led the review. She says there are some textbooks in UNRWA schools with what she called problematic materials.
Mathematics being illustrated by, killing how many Zionists is, in my view, something that should not be in a textbook and certainly not in a textbook in an UNRWA school.
And Colonna says some staff post their political views on social media.
One person can have political opinions, of course, but importing these opinions, making them public, sometimes affecting the operational capacity of the agency is not what should be done. So this is what we called interference and breaches sometimes to the neutrality principle.
Israel has also accused about a dozen UNRWA staff of participating in the October 7th attacks. The panel did not look into those allegations. There is a separate investigation into them. Israel's concerns led more than a dozen countries to pause funding to UNRWA. 10 of those countries, including Canada, have since resumed funding. Well, for the sixth straight day, pro-Palestinian protests have taken over New York's Columbia University campus, leading to more than 100 arrests and the cancellation of in-person classes. Paul Hunter has more on the heightened tensions and the pointed political reaction.
What are we doing here? Why are we marching them through here?
Even as police in New York took a couple of protesters into custody this morning, yet more pro-Palestinian demonstrators gathered at Columbia University and in neighboring Connecticut at Yale. In-person classes at Columbia today were canceled. Michael Gerber is deputy commissioner of the New York Police Department.
Our officers obviously are going to take action to prevent crime and to make arrests if there is a crime. So obviously, any kind of violence is not going to be tolerated. Any kind of property damage is not going to be tolerated. Any sort of criminality is not going to be tolerated.
The demonstrators, countless, camped out in tents on university grounds, are pressing the schools to walk back their support of Israel as Palestinians in Gaza continue in immeasurable suffering. Now more than 6 months into Israel's war on Hamas in Gaza, sparked by the Hamas attacks on Israel October 7th.
Go back to prison!
Overnight at Columbia, video of what appears to be a pro-Palestinian demonstrator chanting at Jewish students, Go Back to Poland, an apparent reference to the Nazi death camps for Jews in that country in World War II.
Can we get some public safety? Wait, no, I'm scared.
Many in the pro-Palestinian crowd underline the extreme demonstrators are agitators who don't represent the rest of them. The broader message, they say, targets the Israeli government, not the Jewish people.
We have been in contact with the school.
Kaz Daughtry with New York Police today advised Columbia to provide so-called safe corridors where police could be put in place for Jewish students who don't feel safe.
If any of the students wanted to go off campus, to go to wherever they want to go, but we advise them to use our safe corridor pathways.
Still, U.S. President Joe Biden warned of what he called the alarming surge of anti-Semitism in our schools and beyond, calling it reprehensible and dangerous.
I condemn the anti-Semitic protests. I also condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians.
Police emphasize there have been no credible threats against any students, but Joe Biden seemed to suggest the broader threat cannot be ignored, pledging, as he put it, the full force of the U.S. government to protect the U.S. Jewish community. Paul Hunter, CBC News, Washington.
Ottawa police are investigating allegations of hate speech at a pro-Palestinian demonstration on Saturday. Video posted to social media includes the voice of someone leading a crowd and praising the deadly Hamas attacks of October 7th. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau posted a statement yesterday saying the rhetoric has no place in Canada. Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre also condemned what he called pro-genocide, anti-Semitic chants. It was a verdict that had many observers breathing a sigh of relief and a case that left legal experts shaking their heads. This weekend, a Toronto jury found Umar Zamir not guilty in the first-degree murder of a police officer. Now, some are questioning if the case should have ever gone to trial in the first place. Thomas Dagler explains.
We wanted people to know the truth. Thank God it came out.
They've had a day to process the jury's verdict, acquitting Umar Zamir in the death of a Toronto police officer. Now Zamir and his wife Ida Sheikh tell CBC News they're not looking for an apology.
We want to move on from what happened.
We just want them to believe our truth. Even the officer's family, we wish they would believe what actually happened.
The family faced intense public scrutiny ever since that night in July 2021 when they were in a car with their young son parked underground. Plainclothes officers searching for a stabbing suspect started banging on their window. Zamir testified he panicked and mistook the police for criminals. So he sped out, fatally running over Detective Constable Jeffrey Northrup. Toronto's then police chief called it an intentional and deliberate act, and prosecutors pursued the case as first-degree murder.
I can tell you this, it should never have made it this far.
Zamir's lawyer, Nader Hassan, isn't the only one asking how the case made it to trial. Observers like lawyer Lydia Riva are demanding answers, too.
So one would hope that there'd be some type of review or accountability for the situation that this innocent man found himself in.
Court heard from three officers whose testimony was contradicted by video evidence and crash reconstruction experts. Even the judge who granted Zamir bail described the Crown's theory as running contrary to logic and common sense. University of Ottawa criminologist Michael Kempa put it this way.
It was a very unconvincing argument that the Crown had pretty much from the get-go.
This evening, Toronto Police Chief Myron Demkew announced he's asking Ontario Provincial Police to look into concerns raised by the trial judge and is also ordering an internal review of procedures when his officers are on duty in plain clothes. The news coming more than 24 hours after Demkew publicly questioned the jury's verdict.
I share the feelings of our members who are hoping for a different outcome.
Pointedly, he now says he respects the judicial process and accepts the jury's decision. Earlier, Mayor Olivia Chow distanced herself from it all.
It's really, at the end of the day, up to the chief to manage the police services, and it's not my place to comment on it.
Zamir's lawyer says Toronto police have lessons to learn from this, whether or not the family later pursues legal action of their own. Thomas Dagg, CBC News, Toronto.
It looks like lawmakers in the UK are in for an all-nighter. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is trying to force through legislation that would see failed asylum seekers from many regions of the world sent to Rwanda. The plan has been controversial and in flux for months. But today, Sunak said deportations are going to start within weeks. Briar Stewart has the details from London.
Hours before Britain's parliament started voting on the contentious bill, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak stood at a podium proclaiming his beleaguered Conservative government would stop the boatloads of migrants arriving on Britain's coasts by soon starting flights to deport those living here illegally.
No ifs, no buts. These flights are going to Rwanda.
The plan to send Britain's failed asylum seekers to Rwanda was first proposed under Prime Minister Boris Johnson 2 years ago, but the agreement with the East African country never got off the ground because of opposition, including from human rights groups and the UK Supreme Court. But the government is still pushing ahead with the plan. Sunak says the flights would begin in 10 to 12 weeks.
With a regular rhythm of multiple flights every month over the summer and beyond.
Sunak says the charter planes have already been booked to fly migrants to Rwanda where they can claim asylum. But off the coast of France, where hundreds, even thousands of migrants from Africa and the Middle East are camped in squalid conditions, few see possible deportation to Rwanda as a deterrent. They're still willing to risk their lives to try and cross the channel.
I try my chance. It's important.
Because I know that Rwanda can never be safe for me. That's why even I risk myself to come through sea.
Inside Parliament, there remains plenty of opposition.
We will oppose it every step of the way.
Alison Thewlis is an MP with the Scottish National Party.
This legislation is utterly despicable. It is state-sponsored people trafficking. It is against...
The upper chamber, the House of Lords, has been pushing for changes to the bill for weeks. It ended up being shuttled back and forth between the two houses late into the night as Sunak called on Parliament to keep working until it was passed.
There is still inevitably going to be further legal challenges because we
Sonia Skeets is the executive director of Freedom from Torture, a group that works with asylum seekers. She told CBC News that even if the plan is eventually approved, public pressure against it will ramp up.
This scheme is really unpopular with the British public, and not even because of the astronomical cost, but because it is just so extraordinarily cruel to people.
She believes not only will individual asylum seekers challenge their cases in court, but she expects the public to put pressure on any airline that's agreed to run these deportation flights. Briar Stewart, CBC News, London.
After more than a year of civil war in Sudan, 8 million people have been displaced from their homes. As many as 18 million are facing starvation. And yet, international attention and aid remains focused elsewhere, even as experts warn Sudan is at risk of becoming a failed state. Senior international correspondent Margaret Evans reports.
When the guns are silent, Omdurman, Sudan's second biggest city across the Nile from Khartoum, has the look and feel of a ghost town. Agency video shows streets empty, save for the wreckage war leaves behind, the eerie creak of a destroyed tank floating through the silence. No more distressing, though, say residents still there, than the silence of the outside world. We are a third world country, says Bashir Awad. No one cares about us. Neither the Arabs or any other country has stood with us. Sudan descended into war last April when two generals who staged a joint military coup in 2021 turned on each other. 8 million people have been displaced and 18 million are suffering food insecurity. Justin Brady is the coordinator of the UN's aid effort out of Port Sudan.
We have a famine warning, both parties to the conflict, creating some obstacles for us to be able to reach those that are in dire need right now.
The suffering Sudan's war has inflicted made a slight dent in global indifference last week as the one-year anniversary of the conflict's start came and went. That was thanks in part to an international donor conference raising over $2 billion U.S. dollars in pledges, but just half of what was hoped for. The French president, Emmanuel Macron, Macron told reporters, it was our duty to make it clear that we're not forgetting what is happening in Sudan. Critics say that is what's happening, in the absence of more pressure on both sides for peace talks.
Because right now there's nobody with enough leverage over either of them to get them to that table.
Yasmin Abdul-Majid is a Sudanese activist based here in London.
Both of them have enough backing from outside to continue the conflict.
The United Arab Emirates has long been accused of sending arms across the border from Chad to the rapid support forces controlling most of Darfur and accused of repeating genocidal atrocities committed by the Janjaweed militias 20 years ago. Iran has also been accused of providing the other side, the de facto Sudanese army, with drones. Regional expert Ahmed Suleiman thinks it's possible Iran's apparent interest in a foothold in Sudan might encourage Washington to engage more firmly.
To get the US, to get the regional states who are involved and engaged in the conflict to act, it seems that it has to be connected in some way to these greater global shifts and threats, particularly to the West.
Yasmin Abdul-Majid says the suffering of the Sudanese people asking for help should be enough. Margaret Evans, CBC News, London.
And finally, I'm sure someone told Luke Bryan to break a leg before his Vancouver concert on Saturday night, and the country music superstar almost did. Brian went down hard in the middle of a song. Turns out cowboy boots don't have much traction when you slip on a cell phone that's been thrown on stage, one of several objects tossed from the crowd. It's something that's been getting on the nerves of other performers lately, but instead of lashing out, Brian laughed it off.
It's okay. My lawyer will be calling. All right, I gotta see it.
Brian dusted himself off and before the next song went looking for the instant replay, pulling another phone from the crowd, one that was recording.
Did anybody get that? I need some viral. This is viral, all right? This is viral.
Oh, I got it right here.
All right, let's zoom in. There we go. I'm jumping. There it is.
Sure enough, video of the fall is getting that viral attention Brian wanted, even if he is a little sore today. This has been Your World Tonight for Monday, April 22nd. I'm Stephanie Skenderis. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.